This is Mark, the podcast producer. Just a quick note before this episode starts. Because of the amount of detail in the story of Bletchley Park's work for the Allied strategic bombing campaign, we've split this show into two episodes. This second show covers the latter part of the war. Now over to the show.
From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to this additional episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. Bletchley Park and Bomber Command, Part 2. The crews of RAF Bomber Command had one of the most hazardous jobs of the war. Flying by night to their targets in occupied Europe, they were alone and vulnerable to the prowling German night fighters. Helping them reach their targets was one of the least known but most significant achievements of the signals intelligence operation at Bletchley Park. Analysis of the night fighters' communications revealed priceless insights into the German defensive system and how it could be evaded, outwitted, and ultimately manipulated. In this It Happened Here episode, Bletchley Park's research officer, Dr. Thomas Cheetham, tells us about one of Bletchley Park's most important contributions to Britain's total war against Nazi Germany. Many thanks to Dean Anderson and Mr. Lindsay Spence for voicing our archival documents.
This is Bletchley Park. It happened here.
The green light flashes on the control tower. That's the sign. It's our turn to go now. We're fourth to go. And the whole of our four engines are giving out a full-throated roar as we start to slowly gather speed down the mile-and-a-half long runway. Ahead of us, the third aircraft's already airborne. We can see the port and starboard lights shining like red and green stars in the dusk. We're racing to join it, gathering speed now all the way past the control tower. Just a little group of ground crews giving us away as we disappear now, moving rapidly all the time. I'm just looking up. We are still on the ground. It takes all this time to get off. But now, at long last, there we go. We're clear. We're airborne and on our way to join the stream of bombers making towards Berlin.
We're halfway through the war now. We're in 1942. This is the point where the Allies get serious about the bombing campaign, don't they?
Yeah, we see a big ramping up of the effort in 1942. There's a feeling in the RAF that the bombing hasn't been carried out very well up to this point. They've been quite disappointed in terms of a lot of their earlier assumptions about the level of accuracy they could attain have been proven to be overly optimistic. And it really comes down to whether you pour resources into this problem and try and fix it or you give up. And they choose the former. So it's still the best way of striking back at Germany ultimately. And there's enormous propaganda value and political value in that. So the British really go all in on strategic bombing. They get rid of the old head of Bomber Command, who was Richard Pearse, and they appoint Arthur Harris as Commander-in-Chief Bomber Command from February 1942. And by that point, he's undoubtedly an ardent proponent of area bombing. But before he comes in, the Air Ministry had already issued the orders which would lead to bombing of German cities on the basis that if you cause enough destruction to homes as well as factories and dockyards and all the industrial infrastructure, you can damage the German economy by destroying the morale of the workers rather than just destroying the factories. And as I alluded to earlier, Bomber Command, they're getting more and heavier aircraft. The Lancaster comes in for the first time in 1942, and they're getting good new navigational systems as well, which are helping them hit their targets more accurately. And the other factor, of course, is that the Americans have come in and they're carrying out day bombing from Britain increasingly from the middle of 1942. In early 1943, you have the beginning of what you might call the combined bomber offensive, because you have the Casablanca Conference out in Morocco in February 1943. And as a result of the conference, there's a directive issued which orders the progressive destruction and dislocation of the German military, industrial and economic systems, and the undermining of the morale of the German people to a point where their capacity for armed resistance is fatally weakened.
So with the ramping up of the Allied bombing campaign, who's got the upper hand now? Is it the Allies or is it the Germans?
If we look at sort of the early part of 1943, things are going quite well for the Germans. They're causing a lot of damage to the Allies. And, you know, for the British, raids are quite consistently approaching the kind of 10% losses per raid, which are just not sustainable and would, you know, cause the bomber force to diminish. So they need to change things, and they have a new weapon up their sleeve at this point. We've talked a lot recently about graduates of Newnham College at Bletchley Park. There's another Newnham College graduate who works at the Telecommunications Research Establishment, which is the British Centre for Radar Development.
Right.
Based at Malvern, I believe, by this point. That's Joan Curran. Joan Curran's invention, which will tip the balance back in the favour of the Allies, is what's codenamed at the time Window. We call it generically chaff. It's essentially aluminium strips cut to the right length that they disrupt the wavelengths of the German radar systems and blind them and cause interference. And by dropping these strips out of aircraft, you can cause fake signatures on the radar displays, and you can make it very difficult for the ground controllers to work out what's an aircraft and what's just a cloud of foil strips. Mm.
They're like ghost images, aren't they? They just snow up the radar
screen. And the British have known this for a while, and so have the Germans. And neither side have used Window because they're worried that the other side will immediately retaliate and the damage will be worse for them than it will be for the enemy. But finally, the British get to the point where, again, R.V. Jones has been banging the drum about Window for a while, and he finally gets his way, at least that's the way he tells the story. And they decide to employ it for the first time during Operation Gomorrah, which is five nights of raids on Hamburg in July 1943. And again, the signals intelligence proves so important here because it shows immediately how much of an impact Window is having, because they are listening in on the German fighter controllers and exactly how much difficulty they're having and exactly how much difficulty it's causing them. And R.V. Jones actually goes down to Kingstown to listen in on some of these German broadcasts to see how things are going.
The Essen raid started normally enough. One of our bombers was shot down a minute after midnight, presumably an early casualty and protected by Window, since the first aircraft in the smoke screen must always be vulnerable. But soon we heard the ground controllers in various states of perplexity, not only in trying to follow our bombers, but also their own fighters. One control lost his fighter for 18 minutes, repeatedly asking him to make the identifying right-left waggle, Ralph Leeser, which should have caused his radar echo to wax and wane. I heard the controller getting more and more exasperated, presumably because his giant Wurzburg had fixed on one packet of Window instead of the fighter. Even his most stentorian Ralph Leeser machen produced no response from the Window. While another controller told his aircraft, "Break off, the bombers are multiplying themselves." A fighter complained that his controller could not even tell him whether the bombers were coming from the north or the south. All these fragments indicated that the Kammhuber system was substantially disrupted.
Extract from the book Most Secret War by R.V. Jones.
And so as a result of Window, the pendulum swings back towards the British. And they do very, very heavy damage to Hamburg. And I think there's a lot of evidence now that the damage to German industry done in the middle of 1943 is almost terminal. Luckily for the Germans, Arthur Harris decides to make the most of this advantage and decides to carry out a heavy campaign of bombing against Berlin. And Berlin is that much further away than most of the German cities. It's much better defended, of course. And really, Bomber Command squanders a lot of the advantages that it gained by bombing Berlin.
The other factor with Berlin is that it's a very widespread city. It's not as confined as many German cities are, especially industrial cities. It's loads of suburbs, isn't it?
Yeah. So again, the assumption is you drop enough bombs and morale will crack. And it simply doesn't happen in the case of Berlin. And not enough damage is really done to industry. And a lot of bombers are lost in the process. So by the end of 1943, the Germans have kind of weathered the storm and are starting to recover. And very soon, Bomber Command is going to be switched over to supporting preparations for Overlord, hitting transportation targets in France and Western Germany. So that's going to take the pressure off the Germans. But in the meantime, again, that tactical sort of arms race has carried on. The Germans have got a new system. They've abandoned the old Kammhuber system of having one ground controller controlling a single night fighter, because that just simply doesn't work anymore.
Mm.
And they go to what they call running commentary. So you will have a ground controller in a control room getting intelligence about the progress of the Allied raid from all the sources he can muster. And he's broadcasting to the night fighters about what's going on. And they either act independently, trying to follow his instructions, but effectively night fighting blind, which they call wild boar tactics or wilder Sau. Or they have another tactic called Zamasau, which means tame boar, where they form a group of night fighters up and the controllers direct them as a mass to try and intercept the bomber stream wherever it is directed. And quite often the Germans, by this point, their air forces are being quite badly damaged. They're using more single-engine fighters, so your Bf 109s and Focke-Wulf 190s, which are not designed as night fighters and don't really have the nose radar or any of that equipment that they really need. So they rely on being able to pick out bombers in searchlight beams or against the flames from the targets below, rather than using airborne radar. But again, Kingsdown is monitoring all of this and able to deduce a lot from the German running commentary. And then you have a very interesting period in late 1943 where the British realise they can start spoofing the Germans.
How?
So the British have a large radio transmitter in Sussex, which they call Aspidistra, after the song, the biggest Aspidistra in the world. And they start using this to broadcast fake orders to the German night fighters, pretending to be the fighter controllers, and direct them away from the bombing raid. So the Germans obviously immediately cotton onto this. And they try to outwit the British by using female controllers. But the British have plenty of German-speaking WAFs they can just put on the airwaves, so they do that. And then there's a very interesting period where the Germans start broadcasting classical music. So, you know, if it's Mozart, the target's Bremen, and if it's Bach, the target's
Mannheim
whatever. But that doesn't last for very long. And eventually, this sort of degenerates into both sides, just jamming each other as much as possible. But it's a fascinating back and forth towards the end of 1943 when the British are trying to spoof the Germans, and that idea of manipulating the German system is one that's not going to disappear completely.
We're well in now, right over the heart of Germany. Thank the Lord that clouds came to help us in. They're lying now below us like a level floor. And at the moment, we're moving over a patch of cloud that's lighter than the rest. And the skipper's just warned us in our intercom. There are searchlights below. They're trying to light us up against the crowd and make us an easy prey for the night fighter. They're about all right because only a moment ago we saw just a stream of red sparks away to the starboard. Must have been tracer from night fighters, and now there go the flares, two or three of them in a row. The night fighters are obviously trying to outline us again. There'll be probably one now out to port as those flares have gone down to starboard and our mid-upper turret is swinging round onto them all the time. Now the flares have dropped down to be swallowed in the cloud, just a red glow on the cloud, and we're in the darkness again with an hour to go to the big city.
I think it's about time we returned the story to Buckinghamshire. How's BP feeding into this strategic picture?
Well, from late 1943, it really comes into its own.
Right.
Because with all of that upheaval after the introductory window, firstly, the German tactics are changing very, very quickly. And it's a moving picture. And Bletchley Park is following that. But it gives new opportunities as well, because while there's this period of chaos and upheaval, signal security goes to pot on the German side. So they're getting more traffic and better traffic than ever before. And a lot of the code words are being dropped. And a lot of it is just plain language. So they're able to track a lot of these changes very easily. So what the subsection history says is the section therefore found itself for the first time in possession of a vast mass of valuable and intelligible traffic dealing with a subject for which there was, again, no other good intelligence source. And that's all going out as part of these BMP reports. And they are changing over time as well into something that's less statistical and more providing a narrative of what happened. And they're making increasing use of different ways of presenting their findings. So they're using a lot of maps. And they start issuing different sorts of reports. They have what they call tactics reports. And then they come up with a shorter version of that, which is called distilled tactics, or DISTAC for short. And they start doing, these very punchy, very digestible tactical reports. But on the other end of the scale, long-term studies, which they call the BMP X series, which look at a period of a few weeks or a few months and look at the sort of prevailing trends in the German tactics. So these are providing intelligence for a range of customers, and most important, of course, is Bomber Command headquarters itself. Up to this point, Bletchley Park hadn't had many direct links with Bomber Command, because most of the intelligence it's producing is going straight down to the Air Ministry in London, and they're choosing what to send on.
Okay.
And they're not always as au fait with the opportunities as Bletchley Park would be themselves. But BMP starts to go direct to Headquarters Bomber Command because of a visit by the Chief Intelligence Officer, who's Air Commodore Nigel Painter, known as Peter Painter, in early 1944. And also Harris's Chief of Staff, Bob Saunby, also visits Bletchley Park at one point. But Painter was well informed about signals intelligence because he'd been head of intelligence at RAF Middle East earlier in the war. So he was in the ultra picture and he knew all about what signals intelligence could achieve. So when he visits Bletchley Park, he sees a lot of the reports which aren't being fed through from Air Ministry. And he actually asks for them to prepare a version of the BMP that can be ready for 9 o'clock every morning. This is when Bomber Command has their morning briefing. They know it as high mass. And the first item on the agenda every morning is what happened last night. Bomber Harris comes in, sits at his desk, and Painter explains to him how the previous night's raid went. And Bomber Command had been getting the BMP, and they'd been getting their personnel in their signals office to summarise it to provide the basis of what Painter would tell Harris at the morning briefing. But Painter requests for Bletchley Park to do that job, and they provide a very short version, which is telephoned through at 4:09 a.m. every morning, which is known as the preliminary BMP. We actually hold copies here of all of those reports. What's really impressive about it is they're able to take all of the night's action and within a few hours summarise it all down into a couple of paragraphs, less than one side of foolscap, covering the entire night's action. And that's the basis of the briefing to Bomber Harris every morning.
I hate to ask you for more when you have given us so much, but I enclose a copy of the report which the CNC has been getting from the signals branch here at about 1600 hours on the day following an operation, which is informed that has suited us very well indeed. Do you think your people could produce anything like it in the time? If they could, we should be most grateful. The reactions of the air officers commanding and the air staff here to what you have been giving us have been very favourable indeed, and I think that the BMP is being put very much more on the map as far as Bomber Command is concerned. Extract from a letter from Peter Painter, Bomber Command Chief of Intelligence, to Josh Cooper, dated 28th of March, 1944.
For other commanders in the field, they have an SLU for their intelligence. Is there an SLU for Harris then?
Eventually there is, but SLUs, Special Liaison Units, they're specifically for Ultra coming out of Hut 3.
So this is not classed as Ultra?
And this is not classed as Ultra. This is based on low-grade material. Ultra is definitely part of the picture. An air section from, I think, September 1943 are all in the picture about Ultra, and they're able to use it. But it's not their primary source. It's only quite a small leavening of what they're producing. So their material is not classed as Ultra. It's classed as Pearl.
Okay.
Which is, Ultra is intelligence, which is the product of the breaking of high-grade Axis ciphers. Mm. Pearl is the product of the breaking of low-grade Axis ciphers.
Ah, okay.
And so security is much less of an issue. Bomber Command does have an SLU. It comes online around the time of D-Day, but actually we don't see any traffic pass through it till August 1944. And this has led to a certain amount of controversy over whether actually Bomber Harris did have any access to Ultra. I'll say right now that he definitely did, but it's a subject we're going to come back to in a later episode, because the reason for that is that Ultra gives you a different form of intelligence here. It really feeds into the big strategic picture. It's more important in damage assessment and engaging the impact on the German economy of the bombing rather than
tactical
level of what happened on the previous night's raid. It certainly has a place there, but it's not the most important contribution of Ultra. The low grade is more important. So we will come back to that in a future episode.
Next year. Now, unlike most episodes where we're talking about Ultra, this isn't Ultra, but what's the impact of this different SIGINT that they're gaining?
It's really profound, and it's very impressive how joined up this system becomes. So every night, the bombers leave, and sort of this system clicks into action. And the most immediate part of it is run from RAF Kingstown, and they have what's known as the Kingstown hookup.
Right.
Because it hooks up all these different elements together into one system of sharing intelligence in real time. So you have a system for listening in on the German transmissions, translating them, interpreting them, doing direction finding on any transmissions from aircraft that you hear, and reporting that to all of the other authorities that need to know of it, whether Bletchley Park, whether the rest of the RFY service. Cheadle is still doing its monitoring of radio beacons and the navigational traffic. So that's part of this system. And they are also given control of the jammers, so they can actually choose which traffic they want to listen to and which traffic they just want to stop the Germans using.
Mm.
You have 100 Group RAF, which is the group responsible for electronic warfare and electronic countermeasures. And they're controlling all of the aircraft, which are firstly aircraft hunting the German night fighters, and also ones carrying jammers trying to interfere with their radar system again. So those are getting real-time information about how effective their operations are being that night. And all of this is being followed from Bletchley Park, and they're building up their picture, and that all contributes to the BMP that's issued to Bomber Command every morning. And that is a really impressive intelligence achievement, because you have numerous types of RT and Morse messages. You have direction finding. You have radio footprinting, which is where you look at the radio procedures of particular enemy units to identify which unit they are. You've got all the cover names they're interpreting. Various map grids that Germans are using are all being broken and decrypted, I suppose, in real time. You've got all the navigational beacons, and they're getting information from Bomber Command about their own planning and their own feedback from their aircraft. All of that material is being processed by the BMP section of Bletchley Park into kind of useful, accurate product, an account of the night's raid covering two or three sides of foolscap within a few hours, without the section being completely overwhelmed by these thousands of items that are flooding in every night.
I mean, that's quite remarkable to do that. There's dozens and dozens of sources, let alone pieces of information coming from each of those sources. That is quite a remarkable feat to do overnight, every night.
I've got a quote from Frank Birch, who writes kind of general history of GCNCS at the end of the war. And he says, in this particular case, the performance of an exceptionally elaborate complex involving the close cooperation, dovetailing and synchronization of a large number of separate agencies and factors marks a high peak in the technique of handling SIGINT in the field. It's one of the key examples he picks out as to just how good Allied signals intelligence gets. It takes a while for the system to be built up, but you know, whatever those debates about who's getting intelligence when, this is all in place by the middle of 1944 when the bombers go back to strategic bombing of German industry. And that's in time for them to have really significant impact, because the Allies drop 3/4 of the tonnage of bombs they're going to drop on Germany and inflict half of all German deaths from bombing after September 1944. So things really ramp up to a very high intensity. And by that point, the SIGINT system is in place to support it. And that's one of the reasons why the intensity is so high. And what you've got to remember, of course, is they're doing it all every day as well. Because I haven't even mentioned it, but they're supporting the Americans in exactly the same way with the day raids. And there is Frederick Pryor's day fighter section producing exactly the same sort of material.
So they're
ready
getting
for their post-raid analysis every night.
So they get their own version of the BMP reports. Right.
And it's absolutely relentless, and yet they're able to keep on top of it. It's absolutely remarkable.
Hello. On your fourth quarter, there's a langer, something weaving over there. Hey, just a moment.
Get over the port, Ken. It's a langer, I believe.
Yes, it's a langer, sir.
My nerve, it's a langer.
Oh, hello, Mid-Upper Gunner.
Hello.
Watch that langer that's just above us, will you?
Yes, very good.
He's diving away. So
he's going over the port.
Hello, skipper.
Hello, navigator.
Half a minute to go.
Okay. Thanks for my...
Okay, keep weaving, Ken. There's quite a lot of bad stuff coming up as well, falling off a bit low.
Hello, engineer. Skipper here.
Yeah?
Will you put the revs up, please?
Yeah? Okay, keep weaving.
A lot of searchlights and fighter flares, skipper.
Yeah, keep on.
Okay, boys, okay.
Left, you can... bomb door open.
Hello, Bombardier. Okay when you are.
Bomb doors open.
Bomb doors open, Bombardier.
Right. Steady. It's a long time yet. A little bit longer yet. Put in some new
green.
Lob them down
steady.
In the center.
Okay, steady. Right a little bit. Right. Steady. Bomb's going in a minute. Bomb. Two. Three. Bomb's still going.
Hey, Jimmy, tracer behind us, boy.
Bomb's dead, isn't
it? Hurry up, Jimmy, hold it up. Where is he, rear gunner? Can you see him?
Down! Down!
Down!
He's chopped down! He's chopped down.
Did you shoot him down?
Yeah,
he's got him, boy, right in the middle!
Bloody good!
Bloody good,
Jimmy!
Right about Reagan, keep waving at some. Black coming at me.
Okay, don't shout all at once.
Alright. Photograph taken.
Okay, photograph taken. Hello, skipper. Will you turn on to 081? Right, 081, navigator. Don't all speak at once now. Keep quiet, it's okay.
Okay,
Hello, mid-gunner. Did you recognize that fighter you shot on?
No, I didn't recognize it, but it's definitely going down now.
Good, Jimmy, I can see him, boy. Good show. I can see him now.
Yeah, look at him burning. Doesn't he look lovely?
Good show, lads. Now keep your eyes open.
Okay, Ken.
This hugely effective and detailed SIGINT that they're producing, what actual effect and help does that give Allied bomber crews flying over war-torn Europe?
I think the only part of this story that's more remarkable than the intelligence achievement is what they're able to do with the intelligence.
Okay.
Because they get to a point where they cannot just kind of overcome the defences, they can manipulate them. They can pull the German strings.
Wow.
The German reaction to a raid is dependent on the decisions of a small number of fighter controllers who are fallible and human and increasingly also anxious to preserve aircraft and fuel. So they're quite hesitant at times and they can be manipulated quite effectively. And Bomber Command knows this and gets very good at it. Essentially, it comes down to if you have a lull of a few days in a particular sector, the enemy will be half asleep by the time you arrive and the reaction will be pretty weak.
Okay. Is that because the Germans are so stretched at this point?
Yeah, it's because they're worried about overreacting.
Ah, okay.
So they don't often react adequately if you deliver a heavy raid with no warning. But if you deliver a heavy raid and then do the same thing the next day, they'll always overreact.
Okay.
So what you do is you send in your heavy raid after a lull of a few days and take the enemy by surprise. And then the next night you send in a spoof raid and the enemy bring up all their fighters and nothing happens.
Yeah.
A spoof raid involving, you know, maybe a dozen aircraft dropping window and some mosquitoes. And if you keep the pattern of real raids and spoof raids going with the right sort of tempo, the enemy's never able to muster a proper defense. And most of the time you get your bombers into the target and hit it without the enemy really, even though they've got the aircraft. The Germans are still putting a lot of resource into their night fighter force right up to the end of the war, but they're just not able to use it effectively because they're constantly being wrong-footed by Bomber Command and they're able to get to the targets and hit it without really meeting a lot of opposition. Or you can get them to bring their fighters up, waste fuel, waste aircraft, because always a certain number of aircraft flying around at night will crash on landing. And the only reason Bomber Command is able to do all that is because of the signals intelligence and particularly the BMP report, which tells them exactly what happened and exactly how effective their manipulation has been. So I've got an example from late 1944, from the 6th to the 7th of October, which the BMP section actually put in a special report, so we know quite a lot about this raid. And this was kind of the opening night of what's known as the Second Battle of the Ruhr, when Bomber Command goes back to bombing, you know, the core of German industry. And they send in a raid on Bremen on this night of 253 aircraft. And Bremen is in North Germany. It's one of the ports in North Germany.
Yep.
And Dortmund in the Ruhr, 523 aircraft. And these two raiding forces, they form sort of an enormous pincer movement. So the northernmost force swings north, and the raid for Dortmund further south swings to the south. And on top of this, you've got all the standard kind of 100 group countermeasures. So they've got a screen of jamming aircraft using a system they call Mandrel, blocking the long-range German radar. They've got various Mosquito intruders going in to try and interfere with night fighters, and also they bomb a number of targets. They bomb some targets close to where the raids are going to go in to try and let the enemy think that they've already hit their target and are about to turn back earlier than they will. And they also send some Mosquito forces further inland to try and draw the controller's attention to other targets. So they send a force on this night to Berlin to make them wonder if Berlin's a real target.
Right.
And they also send a major spoof force basically up the middle of these two forces. So there's a lot going on. It's a very complicated series of operations, which are very carefully coordinated to try and outwit the Germans as much as possible. And the upshot is, this spoof force down the middle succeeds in drawing fighters towards it, away from the real raids. The force going for Dortmund is initially misidentified as Mosquitoes, so little two-engined fighter bombers, rather than four-engine bombers. The Germans only realise it's four-engine planes when they're over the target and dropping their bombs. And there's no serious night fighter opposition. There is a little bit of fighter opposition over Bremen, but it only happens after the bombers have hit their target, because again, they don't get enough warning to organise a proper defence. And there are charts in these reports of the German radar plots, which they're reporting, and which the analysts at Bletchley Park are diligently plotting on their charts. And they just cover the whole of northern Germany pretty much evenly. So the Germans are reporting aircraft all over the place, and they've got absolutely no idea where the bomber stream is or where the raid is actually headed. And this is the actual introductory couple of paragraphs from the BMP report of that night.
The raid by 523 aircraft on Dortmund was first plotted as 50 Mosquitoes. It was not reported as a large force until the last formation of bombers were passing over Bonn, and bombing had been in progress for 11 minutes. Consequently, there was no night fighter reaction. Fighter reaction was divided between the Bremen raid in the north and the 100 group activity in the south. Although the incoming Bremen raid was plotted from the area north of Terschelling, fighter reaction was not extensive. Extract from BMP summary report.
So Bomber Command is able to hit two of the best defended German cities, two of the most important industrial cities in Germany, on the same night with less than 1% losses, which is unthinkable, you know, a couple of years earlier. They lose 10 heavy bombers and two Mosquitoes in the entire night, which is
nothing to what they had been,
absolutely insignificant. And then to top it all, they send in a spoof raid the next night, and they succeed in bringing up, I think, four squadrons of German night fighters to fly around for a few hours looking for absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
And so this intelligence makes a real difference to the effectiveness of the bombing. And so the Luftwaffe is still well equipped, and there are occasions, there are still occasions early in 1945 when this goes wrong, when the Germans do accurately predict the raid. They get the night fighters in among the bombers, and you have over 10% casualties. They're still quite capable of achieving that. So I really think this is the difference between success and failure, applying this sort of intelligence to hoodwink the Germans as regularly as possible.
This is our last glimpse of Berlin as we look back. We are running out into cloud, for which every single person in this aircraft is directly thankful. But behind us, we're leaving a huge glow of red, winking, blazing, encircled by cone after cone of searchlights. Looking back in it now, you can still see the whole long red line, and the searchlights still leaping up, probing in all directions, for the last wave goes in. red flares fall as we watch. And now over us, one of our other old Lancasters passes, just a black outline against the starlit sky above us. But we are seeking refuge in the clouds now below. There's no doubt about it, as we go away, we've certainly got to the big city. Look, look, yes, they've got him. He's going down, and now we can see him too. He's going down all right. He's burning in a huge flare, and the searchlights get onto him. A cone of 20 swing onto him. We can see him falling now right into that central glow. But as he drops, the whole searchlight cone is swinging back, swinging onto us. The main searchlight is probing for us all the time. Its beam swings past us now. Our pilot's weaving. He's getting out of it. He's down goes the nose of the Lancaster. We feel as though we've been flung around. The wings dip. We're swinging away. That main beam's getting further and further away. We're out of it. And once we're through that searchlight, as we whoa, I got a glimpse of that curious glowing carpet of light. That's all we can now see of Berlin. We're beating out of it home as fast as we can.
This episode hasn't been our normal breaking loads of Enigma messages and producing tons of Ultra that foresaw what the enemy were going to do. It's a different story of Sigyn this episode. So how would you sum up Bletchley's contribution to Bomber Command? We've called this episode BP and Bomber Command. What is the conclusion?
It's the opposite of the usual narrative. It's Bletchley Park helping the Allies, and not anticipating what the enemy are going to do, but helping the Allies be that unexpected aggressor. And, you know, it may have saved the lives of hundreds of Allied aircrew, maybe thousands, but it helped kill about 350,000 German civilians, as well as those in other countries. That's the fact of the total war which Bletchley Park is part of. We just can't ignore that. They're supporting all parts of the Allied war effort, even the parts that we now find morally dubious. But, you know, I think there's no way of getting away with it. There's no way of downplaying its significance, because the impact is absolutely obvious to see. As I said earlier, I don't think you can see Bomber Command carrying out the operations it does without this sort of intelligence backing it up. And the other reason I think this is a really interesting example of what BP does is because there's hardly any cryptanalysis involved.
No.
There's a bit of simple code breaking. There's some interpretation of code words, which is sometimes difficult, but it all boils down to an intelligence problem. And that is so far away from what most people assume this place did. And it's so much closer to what we now understand intelligence agencies to do. I think it really strongly signifies Bletchley Park's evolution from a code breaking agency into a modern intelligence agency.
Skipper Reg, can't our good friend the engineer give us a little bit of a song, Jock?
What was that?
Go on, give him a song, will you?
No, I wouldn't place this on anybody.
Go on, Jock, don't be so bloody bashful.
Don't give me the wind, go on.
You'll never live it down, Jock.
It's not a case of being bashful.
Come on, Jock. Max.
Oh, no.
Maxwell, brace up, Bonnie. Where early falls the dew, and 'twas there that Annie Laurie gave me her promise true. Go on, you carry on now, Jock.
Now,
a Scotchman, and he won't carry on.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.